All right, Terry, would you like to identify yourself, please?
Yep, this is Terry Clark speaking at the 2019 Avalon Air Show. Okay, in the beginning, I was on my way to primary school, aged about 7, and flying overhead were German V1 buzz bombs. So at this show here today, I probably go back further than anybody with rockets. I then joined the Royal Air Force as an apprentice when I was 15. I did an apprenticeship in airborne wireless and airborne radar. Soon after finishing that, I was transferred onto guided missiles. I did the first guided missile course in the Royal Air Force, GMF A1, Guided Missile Fitter Air 1. And that was a project called Blue Jay, which merged into a project called Firestreak. Firestreak was an air-to-air, first-generation air-to-air, heat-seeking guided missiles. So that would fire from a fighter aircraft at an enemy aircraft. And I worked on that for 3 years in the UK, starting at de Havilland Propellers, north of London at Hatfield, moved up to Bolton, where they were building them, and then moved around various Air Force stations, fitting the fire streaks to the Royal Air Force fighter of the time, which was the Gloster Javelin twin-engine Delta Wing fighter aircraft. And I fitted those at West Raynham and Water Beach and, oh, my brain's going the other place, Coldishaw, West Raynham. When I got to West Raynham, which was the first one I went to fit them on, there was a funny thing standing outside the hangar. And it looked like it was all metal angle frame welded on legs, and it looked just like a bedstead. Bigger, but just like a bedstead. And it had an engine on it, a jet engine. And it was the original flying bedstead, which morphed into the vertical takeoff fighters that the British built.
The Harrier.
The Harrier, yeah, of course. And sold to America, would you believe. And from there, I'd been working there for a couple of 3 years on Firestreak, and at the same time, they were firing them at Woomera. They were preparing them at Salisbury, what was WRE Salisbury at the time, and loading them onto Venoms and firing them at Woomera at Jindavik's. And they ran into some problems. They lost control over 55,000 feet, and they'd had a few people have to go back to England, so they sent me out here to give them a hand. And the movements department of the Royal Air Force, who booked all the transport, were so slow that by the time I got out here in Australia, they'd found the problem. So,
you just remind us, please, what the Firestreak was.
Firestreak was air-to-air guided missile, which was heat-seeking. It had a glass nose made by Pilkington, and it had a sensor, which with a revolving little shutter thing in front of it, which picked up on the heat of the enemy aircraft, the jet stream. We used to get, on the trials we did, the Viscount, which was the airliner at the time with a turboprop engine, we could only pick those up at about 2,000 yards. But the hot aircraft, like the Supermarine Swift and things like that at the time, we were picking those up at 10,000 yards. And the pilot would be able to, he'd get a lock-on signal in his cockpit, and he'd push a button, and off would go Firestreak. And Firestreak was, as I mentioned before, first generation air-to-air, and that was thermionic valves. There were no transistors or any chips or anything like that in those days. They had the first test firing of it down at Lark Hill in Salisbury, and they fired the first ones at Salisbury on a ground level firing in about 1954-55. And they used to fire those into a great big net, which was in fact a modification of the nets that the aircraft carriers used for catching aircraft that overshot. as a result of coming to Australia to fix up the problem that was no longer there, they invited me to stay a bit longer and join in the first generation cruise missiles. Okay. So the Firestreak was on a group called 12 Joint Services Trials Unit, which was Air Force and Navy. And then they transferred me onto 4 Joint Services Trials Unit, which was Blue Steel, which was it was a first generation cruise missiles. We didn't call them cruise missiles because no one had invented that name at the time. We called them standoff bombs. And Blue Steel was about 34 foot, 10 meters long, weighed 6 ton, and they hung underneath the V bombers, the Vulcans, the Victors, and the Valiants, and they had an atomic warhead. So you were very careful when you were servicing those. not that I ever worked on one with an atomic warhead, but where the warhead went, that's where the telemetry was for them. And I worked on the autopilot, the flight rules computer, and the barometric unit, because the autopilot made sure they went where the navigator... It was the world's first working inertial navigator on there, made by Elliott's. And the inertial navigator told the autopilot where to go to reach the target, but the flight rules computer controlled it in case the inertial navigator told it to turn too quick. So flight rules computer looked after that side of it and kept it within the rules. The barometric unit, we could set that for the bomb to explode at different levels. So depending on what you wanted to do, if you exploded at ground level, you wipe out all the people and all the infrastructure. But if you explode it at, say, 20,000 feet, you wipe out the people with radiation, but you don't destroy the infrastructure. So you can move in and use the trams and the buses and the factories and all those other things. So that was... I worked on that for nearly 5 years. Then it was my time to come back to England. I was still in the Royal Air Force. So I was back in England. I was posted to a place called RAF Lynham, which is a transport hub for the Royal Air Force. And they were doing tests on equipment which was destined for Concorde. All the particular piece of equipment I was working on was the black box flight recorder, and we had that in a Britannia, long-range transport aircraft, a bit like the P3, I suppose, as an aircraft, bit bigger, but same type of thing, 4 turboprop engines. And wherever that aircraft went in the world, I had to be it. I had to go with it. It couldn't take off without me because I was looking after this piece of equipment that they were testing to go into Concorde. As it happened, that was in 1966. As it happened, we were just coming towards the end of our trials. We got everything sorted out and somebody invented digital. And our black box was analog, going on to magnetic tape information. So that was chucked in the bin, except that we learnt a lot about what we could measure and what we couldn't measure. Then having spent time on the Concorde project, I then decided I was going to leave the Air Force and come back to Australia because I'd enjoyed my 5.5 years in Australia. And
yes, folks, we are at the Avalon Air Show.
And I spent a bit of time looking for a job in Australia. Ended up with 2, both at Woomera in South Australia. One was at DSS 41, which was at Isle of Lagoon, which was the Deep Space Tracking Station 41, which at that time was working on the Gemini project, the American Gemini project, the lunar orbiter. All the lunar orbiter stuff was done at Woomera, photographing the surface of the moon to find a place to land. And also, interestingly enough, checking the gravity of the moon, because as with the Earth, gravity varies all around the place, and they needed to know the gravity of the place they were likely to land, so they knew how much fuel they needed to get off afterwards, because it was rather important that they got home.
And also for trajectory projection.
Yes, exactly. The other job I was offered was on Jindavik, which is a target aircraft. It was a drone. And I thought, well, that would be much more fun than sitting in a bloody lab watching pictures come in from the moon. So I plumbed for the job of working on Jindavik. I did all the radio control, the telemetry and the radar on the airborne side of Jindavik for 3 years. And the Jindavik was... Jindavik was at Evetts Field, which was out alongside the Range E, which is where all the rockets and missiles were fired from. So apart from having all the fun of flying a big drone back in 1967, we were able to watch all the sea darts and the sea wolves and the skylarks and the hads and the hats and Black Arrow, all the European Launcher Development Organisation stuff, saw all that go off. And I did, whilst I was living in the village, I did the photography for the local newspaper. And when there was a big launch, like, for example, when they put up the first Australian satellite on the top of a Redstone rocket, there was a Redstone rocket left over from an American project. And when we put ReSat up, there was a viewing area that you could go out and watch it in a safe position, of course. But being the village photographer for the newspaper, I used to go out there and get pictures of the kids watching the rockets go up. And that was the 20... F-35, taxpayers' money. You can edit that bit out. So I saw a lot of action there, and when the ReSat went up, that was on the 29th of November 1967, and I remember that well because it was my daughter's 7th birthday. So from there, when we were working on Jindavik at Woomera, putting it up in the air for the sea darts and things like that, we also had a commitment at Jervis Bay, and we'd go 4 or 5 times a year. We'd send a team across to Jervis Bay to fly Jindavik for the Navy, and they'd fly over Jervis Bay and they'd bring their guided missile destroyers in and take pot shots at us. They didn't always hit us because we had a system whereby we could offset the Jindavik as far as the missile was concerned by about 30 feet. And Jindavik had 4 180 degree view cameras in pods. Thank you.
possible wind tonight.
Get your moonshot then.